Okay, Pat, go ahead.
Nice
so we're
to
happy
be
to answer questions.
Okay,
so
number four over here.
Yep.
Great, thank you. It's Jim Suva from Citi over here. A question that is both for Jenny and Martin. Jenny, this morning, I believe, to use your words, you mentioned you're pleased with the hand of cards that you have right now. And Martin said that you're going to continue to invest and make acquisitions. So can I maybe help you or help me bridge those two comments? If that is you're pleased with the hand
of what
you have.
Yeah, I was answering a question about divestitures.
Gotcha.
That's all. So they're very reconcilable. Those are we're both in alignment and agreement on those. And so we'll continue to look for doing acquisitions as well.
That's
so,
what I assumed.
Yep, no
is
problem.
Jenny, you're referring to divestitures. And then Martin, on the acquisitions, should we expect similar amount per year as far as the magnitude? Because the last year or so, you've had some pretty sizable acquisitions. Thank you.
Yeah, we have had some pretty sizable acquisitions. In terms of scale and scope for acquisitions, we have plenty of capacity to do what we need to do. So if an opportunity, if we saw an opportunity to spend that amount of money and we thought it was terrific, we would do it. Now, I'm not saying we have to spend that much money. We don't have the money burning a hole in our pocket. So we will continue along our very, what I would consider to be disciplined and measured pace. And as you know, we acquire to extend a lead, we acquire to maybe advance or bring a broader set of technologies into some of our solutions. So our approach won't be any different, whether that translates to spending the exact same amount or even a little bit more, a little bit less, I wouldn't predict. But we do have plenty of capacity and we do have plenty of access to capital to execute the strategy.
But Jim, I've always said to everyone, size is not a strategy for acquisitions. It's never been, so I can't think of any discussion we've had that has been about size. So, meaning if it's big, it's big, if it's small, it's small. So strategies are about what you need to run the business and create this era. So that is really how we look at it.
Okay, let's go to number two.
Thank you, it's Tien-tsin Huang from JPMorgan. Just a couple questions, first on GBS. Just trying to appreciate the balance between margin expansion and revenue growth. Why is it important to expand margins here? Is there a chance to maybe accelerate growth by reinvesting? And then secondly, just on the vertical front in the industry focus, Jenny, you talked about, is there a chance down the road that IBM would stand up more verticals beyond healthcare and financial services within that the context of the platforms you called out?
Well, let me first, before Mark goes to GBS, so when do we decide to stand up a vertical? These are solution units. So they really do mean that there is an asset-based business there. And Tien-tsin and I, we were talking about this, that our services business and our go-to-market is by industry. So we do industry work across all industries, some bigger than others. And then we carefully study which ones you want to set up an asset-based business behind. And so when we've covered now healthcare and financial services, the short answer is yes, we could set up more. But I also don't want to give out this image to my, because it's not true, to all my partners that I intend to be in every single industry. A, that would be, you can't. You wouldn't do a good job on it. And B, where we are between financial services, healthcare, IoT has a lot of industries behind it that are Internet of Things, as you can imagine. And then blockchain is another window into quite a few. So we have a pretty good plate here now of which to really build momentum and scale off of. Could we, and do we look at all of them and what they require? Yes, we do. But think of those as, when Martin showed those standing up like that, as asset-based businesses. Now, Mark, do you want to go on
yes.
to the GBS one then?
Yeah, I think on GBS, we're looking to make progress on both the profitability and the revenue growth side of things. What I shared was very much some of the things that are around our near-term view on some of the profit improvement areas. But to recognize that mix of work part and the whole broad strategy around the new growth platforms. They're called growth platforms for a reason, and that's because we think they will let us return to growth. And we're operating in a marketplace that has growth, so our potential to start to regain share is there. This is all about pointing ourselves to that marketplace even more effectively to go after that.
Okay, let's go over here, number three.
Hi, it's Kulbinder from Credit Suisse. A question for Ginny and Martin, I think. This guidance for the long-term growth of the business, i.e. low single-digit revenue, double-digit EPS, I think you first gave it about 2 years ago. So my question is that if IBM aren't hitting those kind of growth rates, let's say in 2 years' time from now, would you be disappointed? and what prevents you from giving us a timeline as to when you might return to growth? And that's in the context, Ginny, of this morning. You did say you're confident you return to growth. I think investors just want to know when, because 2 years have passed since we've had this initially. How much longer should we be waiting? Thanks.
Yeah. Well, Coleman, first of all, I'm not certainly going to create another roadmap here, giving another long-term target. And that when we said long-term is, of course, more than 2 years. Obviously, when we I can't remember what time frame we actually put this, when we did this in. But that is our model, right? And so I think in how Martin and I both look at it, as an investor, you keep looking at the steps forward that we've been making here. And so not only is it when you look at the business and you look at those strategic imperatives I said earlier, the $33 billion, now greater than 40%, because you're looking at what the mix of our total business is. And that, in itself, its composition changes. Then that yields to another step forward that we just put out as we put the guidance, which is expanding PTI margin, both dollars and margin. So that, to me, is another step forward, and we'll continue to make steps forward. So I know you're, not going to give you an exact date and time frame on there. That would be the equivalent of another whole set of guidance, right? So, Martin, you want to add anything?
Well, two things. One, Kulbinder, I just want to make sure you have it clear in your head. We said low single-digit revenue, high single-digit EPS. I think you said double-digit.
Is that what you said?
That was one of the one-third thing you got wrong, I guess. So you have two-thirds ahead of you, which should go fine. So high single-digit EPS. Secondly, as Ginny said, you know, we're sharing kind of the signposts, right? We spend a lot of time talking about strategic imperatives and how they're growing, so that you can model and look at and figure out, you know, when might that point occur. But to us, it's I think what we have to do is show our investors how we're spending their money, show them what they're getting for it, and give them some signposts along the way. And that's kind of the way we've structured our discussion since we put that longer-term roadmap out there.
Okay. Number one?
Hi, Joe Farizi from Cantor. Can you talk about the 60% of the business that's outside of the strategic imperatives? What's the strategy for that particular piece of the business, and where do we stand from a commoditization standpoint there? Thanks.
You want me to start? I mean, I sure hope we've been really clear on that, because as you look at it, in fact, I don't think of it as one big set of, you don't characterize it all in one way, right? And so that's why earlier on I said it's really important to break it down into the business pieces in there. So basically, if I want to put it in some big chunks, one part is you have our systems business, right? So the pieces that are not involved in the strategic imperatives. And as Tom articulated, that's a business that if I had to put one word on it, it goes through cycles. Now, we have been transforming and transitioning it, but it is basically got a cycle impact in that bottom, in the 59% to be exact, that you were talking about. So you take systems, that. Second part you would go take a look at is the parts of our global technology services business. And as Martin said, again, dissect it, because infrastructure services has been growing. And then he's been the part where we call multi-vendor services as part of our technology services, a new market that he's been making, investing in, that has to scale. So say, okay, interesting. New, you know, late in the year, Tom's got some product coming out. We've been shifting into flash in the systems business, shifting into software-defined storage. In the GTS piece of the business that is in there, you have, well, one piece of it, the team's done a darn good job. That is, it's had the backlog growth for 7 quarters, been growing. Another piece of it, the team has been shifting over into multi-vendor services. We've got a one-of-a-kind capability in this supply chain, and our logistics capability is superior to everyone out there. That's what they're moving into, that new area. So that has had investment in it, and then it will start to scale. And then really GBS, and even it's not right to call GBS all in one piece, the parts that are not in the new areas that Mark spoke of, you break that apart. And the team has done some very good work on the application management area. Mark's got them now, when he called it a growth platform, because it's stabilized now, and he's now got it as a growth platform to say cloud, right? Now, to move it more into cloud in that application management. So it targets down to then the consulting piece, which is really, we've covered that a couple times today. So that's what is, did I leave anything else? Maybe Martin, if you...
Well, no, I mean, Arvind's got some elements as well, right? The transaction processing business
That is in there, that's right. And so that's why it is, to me, it is not appropriate to look at it as one big thing. There's been a lot of movement in there, and back to Kulbinder's question about signposts, right? There's a lot of signposts I just covered in those different pieces and where their movement is.
That's okay. Can we get a mic up here to Mark?
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mark Moskowitz, Barclays. The first question is for Martin. Can you give us a little more in terms of the contribution to growth you talked about for cognitive in terms of middle to high single digits over time? How much of that is going to be driven by Watson versus other? And then the broader question is for the team, and Jenny in particular, the lack or absence of a five-year roadmap that we used to all be accustomed to years ago, is that due to the refined model not being fully in place yet? Or is it due more to the future transaction-oriented business versus less recurring? Mm. Just kind of curious about that. Talk more about the nature of the business going forward. Thank you.
I'll do my both. It's not multi-part, it's just two questions. You know, we talked about the components of the segment models, right? And John talked about the opportunity. So we also talked a lot about Watson as sort of a silver thread that runs through a lot of things. So, and to bring one other point into this that Ginny started with is, you know, cognitive's not a feature, right? It's not like I sold a car, but I added air conditioning so I can charge this much more. That's not really the way we think about cognitive. So the bulk of the Watson businesses, Watson Health, the Watson the platform, right, the thing that people are interacting with and driving conversation services, the bulk of that sits within the cognitive solutions segment. That's where the bulk of that revenue sits. And so when we look at that, and I had the data on the chart, the solution software piece of that grew 6% last year, right? Now, a lot of Watson solutions, if you will, are still in the process of being built. So to create a healthcare business, it's now just over 18 months old. Is that about right? It's 24 already? Okay. So to create a healthcare business, as you know, we acquired four things, right? In very rapid succession, we acquired Explorus, Vitel, then we acquired Merge, and then we acquired Truven. Now, we obviously got those businesses and whatever they had, but the solutions that now you're starting to see our clients talk about have been built since. So they are getting added to, and the point is that they're still new in their ramp phase, right? We're just getting now to the point where Watson embedded in either health, and Mark Van Zadelhoff talked about Watson in security, that's all still new. So as those businesses start to ramp, that growth, security, healthcare, David's Watson platform, that'll sit in the cognitive solutions segment.
Okay, let's go to number two, please.
Katie Huberty, Morgan Stanley. 3-4 years ago, you were going into this transformation, and one of the things you did is provide flexibility to customers in your ELAs, and that was a headwind for a number of years. And so I wonder if part of the silver thread with Watson and cloud is that as those ELAs come up for renewals now, you're seeing a change in how strategic those partnerships are, how long-term your customers are willing to look, the growth in those ELAs, and that we may see some of the financial impact in that annuity business. So given that we're now 3 years later, can you talk about how those renegotiations are going with customers?
Yeah, I guess I'd say a few things, and Arvind, you can join in as well. A couple of things, so Katie. One, the phenomena we talked about was, and still present as well, but the phenomena we talked about was our annuity software business is growing, and that's both our as-a-service business growing within that, but also the usage of the platform is growing because, you know, whether you want to measure through renewal rates or a number of seats are deployed, that was still growing. Outside of that annuity business, which was growing, there's a transactional business, and we disaggregated it between those who had most access to the catalog and those who had the least, and those who had the least were still growing as they consumed more. Those were the most, which was that kind of got shorthanded to ELA renewals. We were giving them flexibility, so as an example, they could take more from Mark Van Zadelhoff relative to what they started with. I don't think that phenomenon is going to end. What is important to us, two things. One, it's important that I think we continue to give them flexibility, but it's really important that we continue to put new function into it. Now, to the extent some of that function is cognitive, I think that counts as a pretty strong case for why you'd sign up and want to extend an ELA. But what's really important is that we continue to invest in those platforms, which I'm going to call on Arvind to talk about in a second, but that we continue to invest in those platforms so that they see the functionality and the roadmaps to where they want to go. Now, we've added a ton of function just last year into DB2 as an example, right? Yep. Arvind, do you want to talk a little bit about what's there?
Sure. So if you look at DB2, for example, which is one of the big components within many, if not all ELAs, we've added the capability to do both what we call a hybrid online processing as well as analytics in there. We brought machine learning into the platform as an example there. We made connections that you can take DB2 data and populate up cloud repositories, both for analytics as well as data science experiences, as well as we are now building out, and we have committed those roadmaps to our clients about building out cognitive buddies to help you manage your on-premise databases as well. So that's an example of the innovation that that Martin refers to, as well as what they get in return for what they're giving us for the annuity streams and the payoffs. A second element is also there's going to be flexibility sometimes as the annuity business also begins to include some of these products running as a service. So you begin to see that that makes, and that's why the annuity side gets stronger and stronger, and the transactional side depends upon what size of catalog that they all want to go get.
Okay, number two.
Jim Schneider from Goldman Sachs. Just a question on margins. I think you said, Martin, that implied in your 2017 guidance is some amount of margin expansion at the total company level. Can you maybe talk about any areas or any segments where you think margins could actually take a little bit of a step backwards this year, and then as you get past 2017, what your level of confidence is that you'll get back to that margin trajectory of growth across all segments?
Yeah, I mean, in the spirit of having a long-term discussion, we'll talk. So I think, you know, in PTI margin, when we think about 2017, as Ginny said a couple of times, and I did as well, the guidance implies PTI profit growth and margin expansion. I think the bulk of that will come from a lot of the work we did last year already in making our services platforms more efficient, particularly in Martin's area. I think Mark has a lot of work underway to make sure he's capturing the pricing power, and you saw some of the things on it. So some of that will start to pay off, if you will, in the near term. The largest phenomena in PTI margin, in addition to those things, which is something we've been talking now for a couple of years, is as a service platform gets better and better scale, margins improve. Now they were at a low rate because we invested so heavily, so we're still not where we want them to be, but we will show dramatic improvement and as a scale. As a service. Did I say as a scale? Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you for listening to what I mean. In dramatic scale improvements in the as a service business. Now, what could change that, if you will? What are the things relative to what I showed you in the segment models? You know, John and the cognitive solutions segment, You saw last year a decline in gross profit margins and stabilized, and you know, toward the end of the year. Now we'll see where that goes. We don't need that to be stable this year in order for us to hit our guidance. At the pre-tax income level, we would expect that we have a much more stable performance throughout the year. So between the work we got last year, the continued improvement in scale, I think that accounts for the bulk of where we see pre-tax income margin. Other elements of this, you know, we're not relying on, if you will, for margin improvement. Tom had improvement in margin last year. We wouldn't expect that to improve across the portfolio in the mainframe. We wouldn't expect it to improve across the portfolio this year. We don't need it within our guidance. So some opportunities still outside of what we're relying on in the margin profile.
Okay, number one, please.
Hi, Keith Bachman from BMO. Martin, this is also for you. As you think about number one, IP income, you've already given your context for 2017, but should investors have the idea that IP income is durable at the levels that you've talked about for multi-years, 3-4 years? And then secondly, one of the things that I don't think has been addressed, as a software portfolio, what's the consequence of that IP income? In other words, what kind of headwind will IBM face as a software portfolio from that IP income transaction? Thanks.
Sure, Keith. So a couple of things. One, well, let's start with the impact, if you will, or kind of how one of the ways we think about it. Keep in mind,
Martin, I think for everyone, just step back a second, and when we talk about IP income, the different pieces of it, would you? That'll help set the ground, because I think it'll be clear.
Oh, okay, I think I know what that means.
Yeah, I think you do too.
Okay, so, you know, I'm going to go even further back. We used to generate $1.6 billion in income. It comes, it came in a few different varieties. Some of it was from our semiconductor technologies. Over the years, you know, it kind of shrunk down, and we built it back last year very successfully. First and foremost, I think it's important to recognize that the code base that we're talking about, out of all of IBM's code base, you know, what we were able to get done last year was less than 1% of our overall code base, right? So when you sit at number one on the patent list in the US, as an example, for 24 years, you got a lot of IP. You got a lot of IP. Now, we're building new stuff. We're building in healthcare. We're building in the cloud. We're building in security. So it comes in a different flavor. That's not what we're licensing. But what we licensed last year was you'd have to round up to get the 1% of the code base. I think that's important. Secondly, the structure of these, you know, they're not exclusive. They are just a license to source code. In fact, if we are in the business, by the way, of licensing intellectual property, right? Every time we sell software, it's a sale of a license for intellectual property. If we license the object code, which we also do sometimes, then it goes in revenue, it goes in profit, and you and I wouldn't even be having this discussion. But we choose to show it because it's source code, and it's important, I think, for our investors to understand the nature of those deals. So they get to take that source code, they get to improve it, and you know they see a growing market. Obviously, they see a growing market; otherwise, they wouldn't have licensed the source code from us and put an investment in to make it happen. So, from an overall code base, not at all an issue. From a structure of the deal, or structure of how these work, everyone's better off. They'll invest in a code base. They'll get it maybe back to growth. Right now, for us, it's declining because it's in a declining market. And so when we looked at, as we said on the call, when we look at the opportunity in 2017, maybe we'll be flat. We don't have to be flat in IP income. But this is a very good, long-lasting model for us to continue to refine, continue to build, continue to expand our partnership. Our partners do like this. So I think we'll expand the number of partners with whom we're comfortable doing this. I think we'll find new opportunities to do this. I think this is a long-term positive for IBM. Does that mean we're going to do $1.6 billion every year for 5 years? No, I'm not saying that. But I do see an opportunity for us to continue to grow this and get it back, you know, better than it was when we were at our heyday. It'll just be different. It'll just be different. I don't know if I answered.
Yeah, you did. Because I think of this as another form of distribution. We happen to account for it in IP. And every competitor I know wishes they had the capability we have, both the understanding of how to do this, the amount of IP that we have, which is, as you said, it's negligible what we're even talking about here. And every company I know who says, boy, if you know anything about IP, you know that the IBM company is world class in creating it, and how to monetize it, and how to put it to good use for the long term. So I think that's why I don't think of this as anything more than another form and a way to distribute. And actually, as Martin said, what you saw, those are really win-wins, because we're continuing to sell just like we were, and they're very incented because they've just put down a fair amount of money there to license it. So you really do have a win-win here that is, took the team a bit of time to find the right kind of model for that. I think it's an outstanding model for both parties. We exhausted you, or you want to get in that GM car?
Number one, please. Let's make this the last question. We've run over just a bit.
Yeah.
Thanks for squeezing it in then. Wamsi Mohan, Bank of America Merrill Lynch. So I wanted to ask about GBS a little bit. I mean, we've been talking about transformation in GBS now for a few years. And I was wondering, maybe you could share some color from an employee perspective. How much have these capabilities really changed and filtered through in your employee base? If you could maybe share some statistics around how many employees had sort of were more ERP centric, you know, 3 years ago versus today, because clearly that's going to be a big driver towards looking at future revenue growth here.
Yes, well, obviously across the whole, you know, 125,000 people in GBS, they're all evolving their skill sets, moving to look and see how they can make their skill sets more and more relevant. We have done some explicit things. If we look at, for example, over the last year, around about sort of 8,000 of our resources that were focused more in the ERP space have ended up playing more of a role in the digital area for us, and that's one particular piece. We've trained up some 4,000 cognitive consultants as well to sort of bring that cognitive process re-engineering piece to bear on top of the 6,000 or so analytic consultants that we have already in the mix. So there are a number of these, I think, areas of growth where this year we're going to be focusing very strongly on the digital strategy capability and building out those practices that sit in that digital strategy part at the top of our pyramid. But it's fair to say that one of the reasons why we're so focused on the practice model is every single person in every single one of those practices has an opportunity to make their skills more relevant and for us to understand how that relevance works in the marketplace. And that's at the heart of the transformation we're going through now, is to be really sharp about that and therefore help our people build long-term careers, but also understand where the puck is moving to and ensure that we build skills in that space as well.
But Wamsi, maybe another way I would add to what Mark described is just branching off of the triangle that he showed. That very tip of the triangle, the team has built is, what is it, you said 35, I've lost track of how many of the studios as an example. So there's been quite a lot of renovation of skill at that very tip. And then if you look at the, where I said the business, when I got the question about the core, cloud application innovation services, that has stabilized. There's been a lot of change of skill in there and building of new ways, agile in particular. These guys have been the biggest implementer of agile. We're on scale, the largest implementation of agile in the world, the IBM company. And so that is where a large piece of that went in, and then the remodeling here. And so when Mark talked about cognitive process reengineering, that's really that piece where there had been that lot of ERP that he's now got structured. And that is the way, those of you remember, I ran this was way, 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 way long ago. So I have a little bit of understanding of it. And that is how you scale change. You put people in the right practices, and then you plow through on that education. And they've gotten to that point that they could now go into these new practices. So that's in the middle. So as you were looking at it, and you said, well, how far along? You know, very good, very good. They're finishing out the middle floor. I don't know what to call that layer. the cognitive process reengineering, which is truly a big differentiation that Mark has tilted in alignment now with where now, of course, I have enough, what would you like to say, size and girth to all these industry solution units that he can tilt big practices towards them. When they're nascent, that's harder to do. But now, Deborah, 2 years in, these got big amounts of work to go after. Blockchain, they got big amounts of work to go after. So that's the other reason timing does make a difference here in what he's able to do now. Okay, Pat? Okay, so let me just, before you guys all hop off, you can just stay for 1 second, it'll be easier. So I wanted to thank everyone because the room is still full and you've spent 8 hours with us. Maybe it's more now at this point. I've lost track myself. And so I want to thank you very much for the attention that you gave. And you could tell we had a lot of things we wanted to share. And as many of you who pointed out, it's been a couple years, as I heard in some of these questions, you're right, that we've been through this transformation. But remember what this transformation was about. This was not because of something that had to alone be fixed. It wasn't because we were just trying to adjust to something. We have always believed and called it an era. And that's what we've been building this company for, was for another era. And it was, we felt time to show you that was a strong foundation now in place. This idea of a unique and enduring platform differentiated by Watson, data architecture, first data first, and this idea that, and it runs on the IBM cloud. And then, as we talked about, even here with distribution, the idea you could build really differentiated solutions, even for I'm going to adopt my young friend here from Stanford. And so even no matter whether you're a single business, you've seen some of the most powerful businesses in the world stand up here, and ourselves. So you could build that ourselves, our clients, our whole ecosystem that is out there building. And then in the end, what all this is about now, where we are, that foundation is in place. And then to that question, so now this is our job, is about scaling and winning. And so we thank you for that. We hope you took away the whole team's passion. You see, we have built a strong, strong team. So if I do nothing else, let me thank the team, too, for having poured their hearts and souls into changing this company for the next era. So I'm proud of them, and I thank you for spending all the time with us. Okay, now you're